with a quotation. The commitment of the United States to Israel's security is unquestionable. The speaker is President Jimmy Carter. The occasion, the General Assembly of the United Nations, the time about 10 days ago. Nothing could be clearer, more straightforward, less equivocal. And yet there is anxiety in Jerusalem, and there has been for quite some time, and there is a quiet sense of jubilation in many of the Arab capitals. Now, it is not as if this statement of America's involvement in and concern for Israel's security was a unique statement. As if Mr. Carter had not been saying much the same thing for all of the months in which he's been in office. He has. About a week ago, he spoke to a delegation of congresspeople in the White House, and he said to them that he would rather commit political suicide than to undermine the security of Israel. But the occasion for that rhetoric was a visit by congresspeople who were concerned that the United States had, in fact, changed its positions vis-a-vis Israel, and that actions of the United States were undermining or bringing into question the security of Israel. What has happened? The rhetoric, the big, bold promises, remain very much what they have always been. The basic sympathy between this country and Israel, the recognition that Israel is a sister democracy, that it believes and practices human rights, recognition that there are a number of specific military advantages to our commitments to and involvement in the security of Israel. At the same time, from the very first days in which this administration took office, there have been a number of actions which Israel to a large degree construes as political signals. At the very least, the commitment of the United States to Israel's security has a number of serious conditions to it. At the very worst, it is conditional. You may remember some months ago when the United States prohibited Israel from selling some of its planes, its fighter planes, to Ecuador, and followed that up almost immediately with a refusal to allow Israel to complete the purchase of some concussion bombs and ground-to-air missiles which had been agreed to by the Ford administration. And this was followed by the president's speech at Clinton, Missouri, in which he spoke of the necessity of meeting the legitimate interests of the Palestinians in any kind of Geneva peace negotiations. And this was followed almost immediately by a series of leaks or direct statements from the White House and the State Department that they found the attitudes of Arab leaders, Assad and others, to be moderating and concerned with peace. And they found some of the statements of the Israeli leaders to be unnecessarily obstinate and difficult in terms of getting the world to Geneva. A new set of characters emerged. The very people who refused under any conditions to meet with Israel or to make peace with Israel was now suddenly declared to be peace-loving. And there have been a series of attempts over the last months to find a way to bring the Palestine Liberation Organization to Geneva, clearly orchestrated by our State Department, this administration. A willingness to bring these people who are by their national covenant pledged to the destruction of the state to Geneva, despite Israel's adamancy in this regard, and despite some specific pledges made to Israel in this regard. Now, at the same time, this administration has spoken to Israel and to the world and promised that she would not cut back on her arms shipments, she would not prevent the flow of monies from this country to Israel. And yet she has made Israel know that an agreement that would allow Israel to purchase the uranium necessary for her nuclear reactor at Dimona would be canceled after the terms of this present arrangement have been met, and that the new agreement would not be signed. Up and down the line, there have been reasons for Jerusalem to be concerned. Because clearly, if the United States is concerned with Israel's security, She is taking some very strange ways of making this clear. The Israeli papers come in wryly, you know, with friends like the United States, who needs enemies. And this position has been seen in the United States. Our paper just a week ago had a cartoon of Mr. Carter carrying Begin over his shoulders. Begin's kicking and screaming, and Carter's acting as the parent might, forcing the child to do something the child doesn't want to do, saying, "Now come now, Menachem, you know going to Geneva is the best thing possible for you." Where does this administration stand? The words seem to say one thing, the actions suggest another. Mr. Carter, whatever else he is or is not, is obviously a consummate political beast. And he knows that one of the first rules of political survival is the fact that if you can't locate your prey, you can't shoot at him. And so he has tried to make it very difficult for anyone to understand exactly where all the zagging and the zigging, the zigging and the zagging, all the words, all the persiflage, all the pronouncements, all the signals seem to be directing. And what I'd like to try and do this morning is to try and see if we can understand the theory behind the actions of this administration, what they're trying to accomplish, how they propose to accomplish, what their philosophy is, because surely that will give us some indications as to what lies ahead in the near and further future. Over the last 8 or 10 years, certainly since 1967, the United States has put out to the world that we are largely a benevolent mediator, eager for peace in the Middle East, open to anyone's legitimate claims, receptive, we'll listen to anyone, we'll take our time, we're here to facilitate peace. If we can be useful in the process, so much in the process, so much the better. We want peace. Peace is an urgent necessity of American policy, because it would allow us to maintain our traditional relationships with Israel and the flow of oil to the United States and the openness of Arab markets, all kinds of things which our national interests suggest are to our advantage. But we have put ourselves forth as an observer, a concerned observer, a benevolent mediator if we are called on. Otherwise, we have no preconceptions of what kind of arrangements ought to exist in the Middle East, and we will not impose our will on any parties to the dispute. That's been the rhetoric. And behind the rhetoric, there has been a clear statement that it is in America's national interest to establish peace in the Middle East, to establish some kind of negotiated settlement to the 30-year-old battle between Israel and the Arab states. We want it for very specific reasons: economic, military, social, and political. Peace is an urgency. How is peace to be achieved? During the days of the Nixon, Ford, Kissinger administration, the theory was that peace would be achieved through a series of step-by-step negotiations. Little by little, the house of peace would be built. And the agreement between Israel and Syria, by which Israel gave back Quneitra and some of the land in the Golan in return for a United Nations buffer force, the two agreements in the Sinai, by which Israel gave back control of the eastern bank of the Suez Canal and then control of the heights overlooking the canal and western Sinai. These three agreements were typical of the kind of step-by-step negotiation that Mr. Kissinger and the two presidents that he served favored. Mr. Kissinger's theory was this: the issues in the Middle East are complex. The passions are deep. Suspicions are deep. Peace cannot come overnight. Each of the countries involved must have a chance to feel the other out and to adjust to a new situation. Israel particularly needs time. Time to rebuild its defenses whenever territory is given back, because Israel alone, which is being asked to give up territory. Time to build up its arsenals with whatever equipment or theories of strategy are necessary to protect itself. Time to adjust itself to the giving up of certain natural resources and political advantages. Time to face the diplomatic, internal, domestic concerns which a democracy must face, the concerns of the people with their own security. And the United States, in its desire to establish peace, was willing to give to the various countries involved certain assurances. We began to broker the peace. To the Arab states, we spoke of we would begin to do certain things for their armed forces and for their economy. We promised Egypt some hundreds of millions of dollars of aid. We promised Syria some hundreds of millions of dollars of aid. We promised to Egypt that we would provide them with some cargo planes they needed, and more recently we have promised them the refurbishing of their jet air force. We promised to Israel that since she was giving up the Abu Rodis oil fields in the Sinai, we would provide her with guaranteed access to oil on which any modern society depends. We would guarantee that we would help to police the arrangements that had been made, at least to the extent of seeing to it that if Egypt brought into the area which she was allowed to move back into greater firepower than she was allowed to under the arrangements, we would make direct protestation to Egypt and try and work things out. We agreed that we would try to act as an honest broker as both sides promised to moderate the verbiage, the propaganda war which existed. We promised to Israel that we would continue to provide her with arms and resources, monetary resources that she needed. And most of all, we promised to Israel that we would coordinate with her any further approach to negotiation, specifically to negotiations at Geneva. This was these were the step-by-step agreements by which it was hoped that the House of Peace might be built. And the Middle East seems slowly to be moving to certain kinds of arrangements. Slowly, slowly, but necessarily, there was movement. Now, this new administration agrees with the previous position that peace is an urgency of national policy. It agrees that there must be direct negotiations between all the parties involved. It agrees that the United States needs to make certain guarantees to the parties which will allow them to be more forthcoming than they might otherwise be. But the disagreement, the change, has to do with pace. Where Mr. Kissinger's policy was one of deliberate patience, Mr. Carter's policy is one of haste, of time schedules. Everything must be done. There must be Geneva this year. He said that from the very beginning of his administration. He's eager to see things accomplished. He has no patience. He has very little interest in process. And one sees this really in all of his actions. He's a man who believes that you throw up the fat into the flame and fire and you see what happens. He's a man who by his own admission is an activist. He cannot sit patiently by. He cannot allow months to happen in order for certain things to happen that in a sense need to happen. Why not, he in a sense said, why not take the bull by the horn and do it all now? Why is Israel so concerned about meeting with the PLO? After all, to make some kind of arrangement in the Middle East, ultimately, they will have to meet with the PLO. Why not now? Why shouldn't Israel give back now all of the land up to the 1967 borders? After all, the Arabs have made that a precondition of peace. To a large degree, this was said by the United Nations Resolution 242. Why not do it now? Why all this backing and filling, this heel dragging, this foot dragging? Why is Israel being so intransigent? And under this new sense of time, of pressure, of urgency which has come into American policy, the fundamental asymmetry of what is being asked of the various parties in the negotiation has taken on a new and for Israel terribly demanding and terribly dangerous aspect. What are the Arabs being asked to do? The Arabs are being asked to take over territory they do not now control. The Arabs are being asked to make some proposals about reparations for the so-called Palestinian refugees and even for proposals of repatriation. The Arabs are, in a sense, being asked to state their maximum demands, and they are being asked, at the very most, in a negative sense, to pledge themselves to some boundaries or to some negotiated settlement or to some statement that there will be peace in the Middle East, to recognize the legitimacy of the State of Israel. Israel is being asked for geography, and the Arab states are being asked for words. And the problem that Israel faces is that once the territory has been given back, it's gone. And Israel's borders are more extended and her cities are more exposed. But once the words are spoken, the Arabs have only to renege on the words. A new government comes in power in Egypt. We don't believe as the government before us did. We don't accept their word. Or one of a thousand excuses will be found to say that Israel hasn't done this or done that, therefore we're not bound by the words that we spoke. In the Arab world, there's a phrase which has become very popular in the last year or so, and that is that when you eat a dinner, you eat it course by course. Which is to say that it is to the Arab world's advantage to regain the West Bank, to regain all of Sinai, to regain all of the Golan, to regain the Strip of Gaza, to bring her armies up that much closer to the heartland of Israel, to regain the territory now that the next course will be easier on her militarily. That when she ultimately moves, she will weaken Israel politically and economically and strategically, and the next stage will be an easier one for her. And Israel remembers all too well that in 1973, the lightning strike of the Arab forces those first 2 days, which took the Arabs to the very top of the Golan, was sufficient to carry in depth right through the heartland of Israel and to cut Israel in two. So Israel must act defensively. It must be concerned with security. It must have some kind of proof beyond a few words that the Arabs mean what they say. And it must have some proof beyond a few words that the United States means what it says. Because the United States argument seems to be this. Yes, we know that there are those in the Arab world who are not moderates. The moderates are by definition believable. Why Assad, a man of his type, should be believable escapes definition for us, for me at least. But there are others, the PLO, Libya, Iraq, who are still radical by our State Department terms, who really cannot be trusted. What guarantee then does Israel have if some words are mumbled which make it seem as if the Arabs accept Israel's legitimacy, Israel withdraws, and then another round of terrorism, boycott, and ultimately war erupts? The administration says, trust us. Trust the American word. The United States is committed to the security of Israel unquestionably. Is it? Can Israel trust America's word? In 1956, you will recall, the United States unilaterally pressured Israel to withdraw from the Suez Canal on the promise that they would arrange some kind of negotiations with the Arab states. Those negotiations never took place. And on a promise that the United States would guarantee a free passage of Israel's ships through the gates of Tehran and the Suez Canal. The United States would see to it that the United Nations force, which was to be stationed in the Sinai, would not be withdrawn unilaterally by General Nasser, by the Egyptians, without certain kinds of prolonged negotiations. In fact, despite the pledged word of the United States, the Suez Canal was immediately closed to Israeli shipping. A few years later, the states of Tehran were closed to Israeli ships, and within 24 hours, the United Nations troops had left the Sinai when Nasser ordered them out. How much can one country, any country, trust the word of another country? Particularly when it is clear that the national interest of another country is not identical with the national interest of, say, Israel. America's national interest in the Middle East has clearly, over the last 6 or 7 years, been very much concerned with gaining favor in Arab capitals, with maintaining the flow of oil, with maintaining the richness of the Arab markets as a someplace that is open to our businessmen. We are clearly not eager to do many of the things which Israel would like us to do. Yes, we have anti-boycott legislation, but our administration fought against it and then filled it with enough loopholes so that any kind of economic warfare, really, that the Arab states want to wage can be waged by them. Israel then is asked to trust in the United States' words. But paradoxically, the very haste, the very sense of urgency which the president brings to his policies is giving Israel again and again evidence that the United States' word is not that dependable. And unless our word is dependable, Israel has to dig in and balk and somehow go against the will of the one great country which has been till now her greatest supplier and support. On October 1 of this year, the United States and the Union of Soviet Socialist Republics, as you know, issued a joint statement having to do with Geneva and the Middle East. The United States and the Soviet Union are the conveners of the Middle East Conference. And obviously both have a major role to play if that conference is ever to get underway. The history of this particular statement is, however, an interesting one. You recall that in August of this year, Secretary Vance made a trip throughout the Arab world. He came back apparently convinced that Sadat and Assad Hussein, the major figures with whom the United States has been dealing, were willing to come to Geneva, and though they had certain procedural reservations and were not saying things exactly the way the United States wanted them to have said, they would come. He came back convinced that Israel, though it did not want to come with any kind of Palestinian or PLO representation, could be forced to come under those terms. Dayan described Mr. Vance's meetings with him and with Mr. Begin in Israel those days as brutal. The United States was using its leverage to force Israel and could. So Geneva would take place, and now was the time to bring in the only other party immediately involved, the Soviet Union. And so the United States initiated the discussions which led to the statement of October 1. We were convinced, this administration was convinced, that Geneva could take place. It would seem to be a Carter victory, and it would have gained for us the momentum which was necessary in the Middle East. The only problem was that the Soviet Union makes no pretense even at even-handedness. The Soviet Union has been, from the very beginning, a staunch supporter of the Arab cause. She has supplied the Arab armies. She has provided the weapons with which the Arabs have made war against Israel. She has fought the battle of the Arabs in the United Nations. She has disseminated the propaganda of the Arabs both internally and externally. And to get an agreement from the Soviet on basic principles for the reconvening of a Geneva conference meant that the United States had to either fudge, find some words which would be agreeable to all, words which would probably not be as forthcoming as the United States might otherwise have been. And so in that resolution, there was no reference to United Nations Resolution 242, which is the linkage resolution, which links Israel's withdrawal to the establishment of some normalcy in diplomatic relationships. And there was a reference now to the importance of sustaining at Geneva, or affirming at Geneva, the legitimate rights of the Palestinian peoples. Now, however, Mr. Vance and those in the State Department choose to understand this term. The term, the legitimate rights of the Palestinian peoples, is a code word throughout the Middle East, a code word which has been popularized by the PLO and their supporters to describe not simply some kind of mini-state emerging in the West Bank and emerging in Gaza and linked by some kind of highway, but describes the claims of the Palestinians to all that they call Palestine. And Palestine was described by the treaty by which Britain got the mandate for Palestine in 1921 and 22, after Versailles, as including all that is today Jordan, all that is today the West Bank and Gaza, and all that is today Israel. And no wonder that the Israelis were concerned. Many in America reacted negatively because it seemed to intrude the Soviet Union into the Middle East at a time when her influence had waned and American influence had waxed and grown stronger, and it seemed to be an unnecessary element in a detente which many of us have become suspicious of. Israel, however, was concerned because it seemed to be a backing away from stated positions of our government, particularly the position which guaranteed that we would not impose a peace, the terms of negotiations. Here, clearly, terms of negotiations were being stated, set out, one step short of being imposed. But most of all, Israel was concerned with the process. On September 1 of 1975, Secretary of State Kissinger had issued a written statement, a memorandum to the Israeli government, in which he had pledged that the United States would consult and coordinate with Israel in all matters leading to Geneva, and that we would give Israel a veto power over who should be at Geneva. Well, the consultation and the coordination involved in this particular statement had consisted of the fact that a few hours before it had been released to the press, the Israeli ambassador to Washington had been called in and the statement had been read to him. If that's coordination and cooperation, the words have ceased to have meaning. And what this particular small action meant to the Israelis was that the urgency of peace, of getting to Geneva, of achieving something, has become so dominant, so large in the American mind, that they are willing to lean on Israel to see to it that our definition of peace, our definition of negotiations, our definition of what must emerge from the negotiations will take place, regardless of all the other words, regardless of any promises, written or unwritten, which we have made. The United States has, by its very haste, has begun to act in a way which is making the negotiations more and more difficult. At least the Kissinger approach, for all of the leverage that it used against Israel, gave Israel some breathing room, gave Israel time to take stock, to make arrangements, to keep up its guard, to react to the pressures that were being placed on her. Now there's no longer time. The surgery is to be done. Israel is to be left exposed, and so it seems to Israel. And she must make the best that she can, trusting in the pledged word of concern from the United States in Israel's security. Now this policy, which Mr. Carter, Mr. Vance, Mr. Brzezinski have been following, emerged in 1975 from a study made by a task force operating on the Brookings Institute in Washington. Brookings Institute is one of those high-level think tanks, one that brings to its meetings the best and the brightest. And this particular panel of some 16 experts in political affairs was to deal with the whole question of the Middle East. Mr. Brzezinski, by the way, was one of those 16. And this particular panel came out with a series of conclusions and recommendations. It spoke of America's traditional relationship with Israel, the importance of secure boundaries, the importance of maintaining Israel's military strength and supporting her economy. It spoke of the need to help moderate the moderating influences in the Arab world. It spoke of the importance of trade in oil in the Arab world to the United States. But it spoke also of what it called the self-determination of the Palestinians. That is, it raised the so-called national rights of the Palestinians to a level of policy, and it attacked sharply the whole Kissinger approach of step-by-step negotiations. It was the conclusion of this Brookings Institute report that one could not build a house of peace brick by brick, the way any house is built, but that one had to go at the whole thing, and one had to force Geneva to take place. Only by attacking the whole problem, seeing all of the issues, ultimately, could some kind of negotiation take place. There had to be a consistent, concerted, and final effort made by the United States government to achieve Geneva, because peace was an urgency of our national interest. Under these conditions, the sense of time, of patience, which Kissinger had built into his policy, is minimized or utterly disappears. And in its place, you get the present policy of urgency, of pressure, of unremitting pressure, pressure which is exerted unequally on the parties to the dispute, because what they are being asked to negotiate is different in kind. One, an attitude which must be given up, one, land, territory, and security which must be given up. This Brookings Institute paper has become, in a sense, the Bible of this present administration's policy. And many of those who were part to the Brookings Institute study have evolved a second series of principles which are not part as yet of the policies of our government, but are ready to be used and are ready explanations for any kind of pressure that this government wants to exert on Israel. George Ball, who was the Undersecretary of State in the Johnson administration and was one of the men who was considered for the post of either Secretary of State or National Security Advisor, published an article in Foreign Affairs, one of the elitist public opinion magazines of the diplomatic establishment, in the spring of this year, which he entitled, How Israel Must Be Saved Despite Itself. And Mr. Ball contended there that a number of new factors had entered the picture since 1973, and these must be the primary factors to be considered by the government of the United States. First, since 1973, the moderate forces in the Arab world were on the increase, were increasingly dominant, and since 1973, the forces of obstinacy and belligerency were on the increase in Israel and were increasingly in evidence. Secondly, since 1973, the oil and the markets of the Arab world had become increasingly important to our national interest, and the military advantage and the sense of solidarity of institutions between Israel and the United States had correspondingly become of lesser importance. The Arab states were a blessing economically and in terms of energy. Israel was a drain economically and politically. Thirdly, since 1973, the Israeli government had become weaker and weaker. The Israeli society had become more divisive. There was no central authority. Fringe groups were coming to the fore. The Israeli government was less and less dependable. Finally, in the conclusion, Israel is now incapable, in a sense, of knowing what's right to her, for her. Time is running out on Israel. Therefore, Israel must be forced to Geneva and forced to do at Geneva what the United States tells it it should do, because only in that way can Israel be saved from itself. Only in that way can peace come to the Middle East, and only then can a diminished Israel, whatever remains, survive. There's no chance otherwise. This kind of logic, coercive logic, reminds me of the logic of the inquisitors, of the priests of the Middle Ages, who remanded men and women to the torture rack in order to save their souls. What it says essentially is this: the United States now defines Israel's national interest. The United States now defines what Israel must give up, must agree to in order to establish peace. Israel's interests are really not to be of American concern for very much longer. In fact, they're standing in the way. They lead only to obstinacy and belligerency on the part of Israel. Now, Mr. Carter has not yet availed himself of this logic, although it's there. And any time that he wants to get very angry with Mr. Begin for refusing to do that or not going along with this, this kind of approach is available to him. It's spoken every day in the corridors of the State Department. Because he is doing for Israel what Israel cannot see she needs to do for herself. I'm reminded of those images of the synagogue which appear on medieval churches, where the synagogue is blind. We haven't seen the light. And therefore, those who have seen the light must lead us to it. Where do we stand and where are we going? Well, Israel stands between the rock and the hard place. She's a small country. Given international politics, she stands in many ways almost alone. America has been her major military supplier. She has certain reservoirs of friendship in Western Europe, Latin America, but these cannot be depended on. Israel will ultimately, if the pressures are unremitting, choose between living dangerously, exposing the one important relationship to her to the breaking point, and perhaps exposing herself on the ground to arrangements with which she cannot live. Where does this leave the United States? This leaves the United States committed to a policy which will inevitably picture Israel in the national press and the media as recalcitrant, as intransigent. For the moment, the Arabs have only to be very vague about what they're requiring. 1967 borders, which is usually not said that way. It's usually said the return of Arab lands, which can mean the 67 borders, or the 49 borders, or the 47 borders, or all of Palestine. And they can talk vaguely about the legitimate rights of the Palestinian peoples, which may mean simply some kind of reparations for those who were displaced in 1947 and 48, or it can be the claim that all of Palestine belongs by some magical notion to those who claim to be Palestinians. All the Arab states have to do in order to gain this round is to remain vague and to retain that appearance of being peace-loving or moderate. But Israel is going to have to live within these borders, and as they are drawn after Geneva, and Israel is going to have to defend these borders, and they're going to be longer after Geneva than they are now, and her major cities will be exposed, and you can bet your bottom dollar that there are going to be guns on her borders. And the United States is going to be left with a moral commitment to Israel. But it'll be very difficult, of course, for the United States to necessarily live up to that moral commitment. We've failed in our moral commitments to other small nations in the world in recent times. This administration, in its haste to achieve some arrangement called Geneva, is also espousing a policy which can only be counterproductive even if one accepts this present administration's definition of the national interest. How is it to the American interest to establish a Palestinian state, a mini-state, in the West Bank and in Gaza? Imagine that Geneva is over, which is something we rarely do. We've concentrated so much on getting to Geneva. Imagine Geneva is over, and this mini-state has come into being. Now, this mini-state will not be simply the people who now live in the West Bank and Gaza, the mayors with whom Israel has lived on some kind of terms for the last 10 years. The mini-state will now be invested and infested by every one of the competing groups of the PLO, from those in the center of their spectrum to those who are the most radical, who are responsible for the present rash of airlines terrorism. And you can bet your bottom dollar that these groups will be supported, as they have been the last 10 years, by Iraq and by Libya, if not by the Soviet Union. And they will ultimately impose a reign of terror on these cities, and then one or another of these groups will get its own way, and this mini-state will become a small armed state dedicated to Palestinian revanchism, to Palestinian rights. And both of the states to the east and to the west, on whom American policy is to a large degree dependent, that is, on Jordan and on Israel, will be there to be subverted, because this little state is not economically viable. It cannot begin to take in the population that calls itself Palestinian. It has the whole myth readily available of why Jordan should belong to the Palestinian state. It was intended to be the Palestinian state in the first place. Why Israel belongs in Palestine. It is theirs by some kind of inalienable right, some alienable Arab right. And the guerrilla warfare will begin in Jordan. The terrorism will begin in Israel. And one fails to see how this state of affairs is conducive to peace, the very thing that America claims is most urgently needed to achieve our national interest. Indeed, if this tier of states, Jordan and Israel, are ultimately subverted, and they become the province of the most radical of the Arab groups, what we have achieved is simply to place these radical Arab groups on the northern boundary of the oil fields, and they will begin, you can bet your bottom dollar, in a matter of days, if they have not begun already, the subversion of the feudal governments of Saudi Arabia and Kuwait and Bahrain and these other little Persian Gulf states from which we get our oil and whom we claim to be such friends of the West. It's hard to see how America has got itself into the position that the scenario which is now being so urgently pressed can be seen to be in our most urgent national interest. Mr. Carter, I think, is firmly convinced that what he is doing is for Israel's best interests. He finds it difficult to understand that the Israelis should think otherwise. He is firmly convinced that Geneva is necessary for world peace. He does not ask himself too often, well, let's say I get everybody to Geneva, how am I going to get them to accomplish anything in Geneva? That's an issue that all the issues, the major issues, have been left unresolved. And this scenario is clearly going to bring Israel to Geneva, the United States to Geneva, and the Arab states to Geneva, and will put Israel at Geneva under pressure from the United States so that something can be accomplished. Because every time in history that the Arabs have balked, it is Israel who has been pressured to make the first step for peace, to open negotiations for peace, to be forthcoming, to do America's bidding. I'm afraid that there's going to be a long, long period in our history, if the president continues on this present policy, in which Israel will be pictured as intransigent and difficult, in which the Jewish community in the United States will find itself and its those who understand its position in opposition to the present administration. There will be attempts to paint Jewish interests as those of a narrow lobby, and there are going to be all kinds of frictions which will affect us, our relationships with our neighbors, our community, and our country. What's for it then? Well, previous administrations have, when they have come into office, have found panaceas which will open the way to peace. And they've learned over the years that the issues are complex, that they require time, that the Arabs don't necessarily mean what we take them to be meaning. And they've moderated as each administration has progressed their positions. Perhaps Mr. Carter and Mr. Brzezinski will learn that you cannot simply wish something to come into being and therefore make it come into being. I keep hoping that some night Mr. Carter will read the Bible. He says he reads it every night, but somehow he's never turned to the book of Ecclesiastes, where it says, you know, that there's a time, a season for everything under the sun, and a time for everything under the sun. There's a time to make haste and a time to be patient. He's a man in an awful hurry. And somehow in the world, whether you're dealing with Panama or South Africa or the Middle East or Europe, haste is not necessarily or even generally the best way to make policy. Mr. Carter seems to bring to international affairs a kind of engineer's attitude. But if you only set a time schedule and you force yourself, you'll arrive at the concluded set of prints, at the goal. But when you're dealing with people, survival and national interests and myths of race and of nationality, things don't work that way. And that's a lesson that this man from Georgia has yet to learn. Someone asked me this morning whether I was going to end on an optimistic note. I frankly have no optimistic note to end on. This administration is embarked on a policy that is ultimately to the detriment of Israel and will make it more difficult for Israel to survive. How long she will remain on this course, only the domestic political pressures brought against this administration and her own hopefully emerging awareness of the complexities of the issues will tell. But if America continues on the present course, Israel will either have to capitulate and give up everything that she's attempting to negotiate for what will be meaningless professions of peace and relatively meaningless professions of commitment to Israel's security, or else she will have to break her relationships with the United States and try probably the suicidal task of going it alone. May Mr. Carter read his Bible. Amen.